Welcome to Insight, live at noon with a rebroadcast at 7 p.m. The Sierra is on the tail end of a massive winter storm, which closed highways and dumped feet of snow on the region. Ahead on Insight, we're going to get an update on current conditions and how much the storm boosted the snow season. Also, Sacramento voters will have a big decision to make during the primary as they decide the city's next mayor. On primary eve, we're focusing on four leading candidates and their approaches to handling two of Sacramento's most pressing crises, affordable housing and homelessness. Finally, 007 fans, there is a spy-themed musical and dance performance opening at the Sophia this weekend. We'll get a preview of Shaken, Not Stirred, inspired by the music of James Bond. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. That's all coming up today on Insight. But first, here's the news. From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. After a three-day closure, I-80 reopened this morning over Donner Summit. Highway 50 is also open, but chains are required on both roadways. And this is as of 12 p.m. today. As we've learned over the weekend, conditions can change dramatically. A brutal, relentless blizzard wreaked havoc on the Sierra. Some places received up to 6, 7, even 10 feet of snow, with peak gusts well over 100 miles per hour. It has been a mess all weekend long, and there is still some more snow to come before the weather hopefully calms down. We're going to get a look at the roads with Caltrans, as well as a look at the forecast with ABC 10 meteorologist Rob Karlmark. But first, we're going to head up to Donner Summit and welcome scientist Andrew Schwartz, who went through the storm himself at the UC Berkeley Central Sierra Snow Lab located in Soda Springs. Good afternoon, Andrew.
Hi, Vicki. Thanks for having me on.
How was the weekend like for you?
It was certainly a busy one and a wild one. You know, I think this storm has been very unique in the way that we've seen storms with bigger snowfall totals. But between the low visibility, the high winds, it was just something to behold.
And I was following you on Twitter, you know, when you were able to post. I mean, it seemed like you went through a good amount of outages and had service compromised throughout the weekend, the last 72 hours or so.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't just I-80 that shut down. We had power outages consistently, the snow lab of the fortunate, one of the fortunate locations where we were able to get our power back and get off backup power. But then we ended up with about 36 hours of our data being down and our slow internet coverage. And so it was very problematic because we were trying to update numbers and get through to people, but it just wasn't working out very well.
And this isn't the first time you've been through something like this. But for listeners who are wondering, you know, how do you stay safe during this? How was it for you personally?
There was a lot of moving snow, but other than that, just staying out of the winds was a big thing. At times it was a little nerve-wracking because in my 3 years here now, I have yet to experience a storm where the entire building shuddered as it did this time in the wind. You know, you could feel it vibrate in some of those bigger gusts. But other than that, it wasn't too bad.
What are conditions like outside right now?
Right now, we've got some pretty decent snowfall coming down. Nothing too crazy, but we are seeing the occasional gust of wind as well. And so still a few more inches on the way, I think. And then it looks like we'll dry out sometime around midweek or so.
I believe you're going to have a firm number in terms of snowfall in your area for the Central Sierra, I believe, tomorrow. But do you have any preliminary numbers? You know, what totals from your location over at Donner Summit?
Yeah, so we've had 6 feet and 3 inches of snowfall through this morning at 8 a.m. There's more coming down today, so it's likely that we'll wind up somewhere between 6 and 7 feet, if maybe just above 7 feet for the overall storm as a whole. Mm.
And overall, I mean, aside from the safety hazards and also what you just went through with losing power outages and losing services, overall, when it comes to the snowpack, this was a good, decent boost that we needed.
Absolutely. You know, we were sitting around 84% of average statewide before this storm started. Now we're at 104% of average to date. And we're at 94% of our April 1st average, which is fantastic. So as long as the storms that we're looking at in the future actually come through, it looks like we'll make it to average at least for this year.
Well, Andrew, as always, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
And that is Dr. Andrew Schwartz. He is the lead scientist and manager at the UC Berkeley Central Sierra Snow Lab. It is located at the summit in Soda Springs. Now I want to bring in Rob Karlmark, a meteorologist for ABC 10. Hey, Rob.
Hi there. Good morning into the afternoon.
Yes, good morning into the afternoon. So you joined us on Thursday as you forecast this winter storm that was to come. Did it meet or exceed expectations?
You know, I think in a lot of ways it really did. And I have to be honest with you, you know, as a meteorologist, when you are putting out the numbers, you know, 5 to 10 feet of snow over 3-4 days, deep down inside, you're really kind of questioning yourself just because that is such a huge, overwhelming number. But as you just heard from Dr. Schwartz, and you'll see other reports from ski areas and so on, it really did in many places match expectations. And in some cases, like you just mentioned, as far as the wind, exceeded expectations. It was truly a remarkable, rare combination of very, very heavy snow along with extreme winds. We usually get one or the other. This time we had both.
Yeah, I was just online, whether it was Twitter or Instagram, following up on, you know, our public agencies like CHP or Caltrans, looking at video. And it was just so extreme, the weather over the weekend, a blizzard over the weekend in the Sierra. What surprised you most?
I would say I was surprised how much the road was open in the beginning. I mean, the plan is always, because there's really vital services and products and things that need to move through there, such as gasoline, food, things like that, that they really do their very best to try and keep that road open. But Caltrans at one point did put out a tweet notifying everybody that a lot of their big equipment were down with this storm, either broken or they were unable to use it. So I believe out of 30 of these big, they sort of have an auger on the front that blows snow far away. I think they were down to 8 out of 30. So, you know, you got to give them some credit. They worked as hard as they could. They kept it open as long as they could. But as I like to say, sometimes Mother Nature wins and you sit back and let her do her thing, because we are all humbled by these storms.
Yeah, I remember when you were saying on Thursday, you were concerned about people who live in the foothills, people who live in these rural areas with limited access to services, especially if they're going to be going through power outages. When it comes to those lower elevations that still did receive snowfall, how did they fare?
You know, I think in that the lower end of what we were expecting, as far as the lower snowfall levels between, say, 2,000 and 4,000 feet, which a lot of people live in those quarters, that's almost what we would call the 49 state route corridor that goes to many populated areas. They got some snow, they got some wind, they got some rain, they got a little bit of everything, but I think they mostly avoided some of the bigger impacts that were really not that far away. I would say 1,000 feet higher from those communities, that's really where their serious business all went down. So I think we still don't know the story. You know, at this point, the snow is just letting up, and sometimes it takes a little while before you start to get the calls and the stories about what really went down in the middle of the storm.
Yeah, I mean, we just heard from Dr. Schwartz that when it comes to snow water equivalent in the Central Sierra, we're doing good. We're 104% of the historical average. If you go to the Northern Sierra, that's 111%, and the Southern Sierra is 94%. Do you think records are going to be set?
I really don't, and the reason why is this. We forget about last year sometimes. We have a very short memory. Last year is really, you know, when you look at these bar graphs from time to time, at least I do, I'm a meteorologist, I look at that stuff maybe so you don't have to, but it's one of those top years. And that was just last year, where a lot of these ski resorts ended up with 700 inches of snow. To date, even with the big blizzard and the monster snow that we saw, many resorts are struggling to even get close to 354 inches. In fact, I don't think any local ones have even gotten there. So compared to last year, we're not going to get there. However, we're still living off the water from last year, and our big major reservoirs are all well above average. You add in, say, an average year, like you heard from Dr. Schwartz, we're probably going to get there for snow. I think we're doing just fine.
You know, we're not really out of it just yet. There is still some activity in the forecast. What's to come over the next 48 hours or so?
So, shockingly, we're still dealing with snow. We have a much more confined area. We call it the Western Slope. That's basically 4,000 or 5,000 feet up to the crest, Donner Summit. We all know Donner Summit, but there's other ones along the way. We're going to get an additional, I would say, 4 to 6 inches of snow over the next couple of days. So definitely, if you think in the valley, hey, we're done, now's the time to head up there. Just understand you won't be dealing with the major blizzard that we went through, but you still have to deal with icy roads, blowing snow, fresh snow, chain controls, all those things you expect with any typical winter storm.
Rob, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
That is ABC 10 meteorologist Rob Karlmark. I now want to get to Jeremy Linder, a spokesperson for Caltrans District 3. Good afternoon, Jeremy.
Good afternoon, Vicky.
So you joined us on Wednesday as well, warning drivers and motorists of what was to come over the Sierra. And in a public hazard way, it did not disappoint. There was severe weather over the Sierra. I mean, how is Caltrans doing?
So we're doing well. Our crews are working like crazy over the past weekend, and they continue to do so. As you mentioned earlier, 80 is back open just for passenger vehicles only right now, but we're hoping to be able to release truck traffic in the next couple of hours. So we're making progress. It's slow and steady, just like how the trip will be for those that want to head up, but we're making some headway.
How are you reflecting over the past weekend? I mean, there were drivers who or motorists who attempted, you know, the trip, and I-80 was closed for the past 3 days. Highway 50 didn't fare much better. I guess what message do you have for motorists? There were spinouts and it was some dangerous conditions for those who attempted it.
Yeah, exactly. So the overall message is just looking back at we had the warnings out there as early as possible, thanks to the help to all the meteorologists that we have in our area. We were telling people avoid travel. And for the most part, even crews going into Friday noticed that traffic appeared to be lower. The volumes were looking okay. Then, of course, we head into the evening hours, and that's where all the incidences started happening that ultimately led to the closure on Friday. And looking back, it's just one of those that we can talk till we are blue in the face and give the warning over and over. But the fact of the matter is there are some people that will just do what they want to do. And that's also what we need to prepare our crews for in these type of events.
Yeah, I think about crews who are working 24/7 nonstop, as you said. Were there any safety issues?
So for the most part, things were fairly good. I mean, we did have a couple instances with our equipment, which is there's always at least one or two during winter season. So crews are having to work with that, do a pair of repairs on the fly, also dealing with the blowers. I know Rob mentioned that. Anytime you have a chain that falls off or becomes loose from a vehicle and now is buried in snow, when our blowers come through, when we're trying to widen the highway, that chain can get wrapped up inside the auger, which now we have to take it back in-house, perform repairs what we can, and hope that it's not severe enough that it has to go down into the valley for extensive repairs. And that was just one of the challenges that we faced over this weekend on top with just the sheer amount of snow. And there were times that our crews would plow and then not even 30 seconds later, you couldn't even tell they came through. It was just coming down that fast.
Yeah, that's just relentless. I mean, you mentioned I-80 is now open to passenger vehicles, and we're talking at noon. We do have a rebroadcast at 7 p.m. Highway 50 also is open, and I was looking at a video on KCRA this morning. There was just so much traffic on 50. I mean, it looked like it was a holiday. What do you attribute that traffic to?
So for most of that traffic, I think that was those that wanted to enjoy the snow. So they either left ahead of time or they battled the conditions on Thursday and early Friday, got safely, but then now heading into the work week, they got to get home to continue their regular duties. And unfortunately, with 80 being closed, that was the only artery in and out of the Tahoe Basin. So I really feel that's what attributed to the backup.
Mm-hmm. What about the smaller highways, more interior in the Tahoe Basin?
Yeah, so we did see closures along Highway 89 near Emerald Bay due to snowfall. 267 that connects the Truckee area to North Shore also saw a closure at one point due to zero visibility. So each area highway was affected to some degree. Chain controls all across the board, and we weren't the only ones. Our District 2 to the north of us had their own issues they were dealing with. District 10 to the south of us also had the whole thing. So it was Caltrans wide. We were dealing with a lot in a very short amount of time.
Yeah. And as Rob mentioned, I mean, in the forecast, there is a winter storm warning in portions of the Sierra over the next day or so. So you're not really out of the woods yet. What is the priority for Caltrans over the next 48 hours?
So the priority is continue to do road clearing. There are some spots along 80 that are narrow. There's only one lane of travel available. So our crews are actively working on trying to widen those spots, allow for additional travel lanes while continuing plow operations and keeping the roadway clear. As we continue to make progress, you might see chain controls juggle here and there based off of conditions. But I would definitely expect they're going to stay in place for quite a while. And for those that are heading up, there's a lot of them moving equipment. So they need to keep that in their mind. Stay slow. And if you pass a vehicle or one of our equipment, do so only once it's safe to do so and take it slow. Ultimately, for those that think we're going to hit the reset button, it's not going to be that quick. It's going to take some time before the highway is back in a condition that it was before the blizzard moved in.
Yeah. And finally, I mean, we're talking at noon, both I-80 and Highway 50 are open. So people may be hearing that and, you know, say, yay, I'm going to go head up to the Sierra or head back over the Sierra to head back home. But that could change. I mean, just because there's still more snow in the forecast. I know it's not a blizzard or that's not in the forecast, but there could be closures again on I-80 or Highway 50, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So for those that are thinking, hey, I'm going to take this time, I want to go up. Our message hasn't changed. If at all possible, you can avoid travel, please do so. If you have to go up, be prepared. Like we saw over the weekend, anything can happen with Mother Nature. So as long as you're ready for it, you can get to your destination safely. And in particular with I-80, that's also one of the reasons why we only have passenger vehicles right now. And we're giving it some time before we allow trucks in. Because like I mentioned, there are some narrow spots. And in those particular sections, all it would take would just be one spin out. And now we have the potential of having to look at closing it again. And ultimately, that's not what we want to do. It's safe to travel. We want to keep it that way.
Jeremy, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jeremy Linder is a public spokesperson with Caltrans. Up next, we're going to have profiles with the leading candidates for Sacramento mayor and how they would respond to the city's crisis of homelessness and affordable housing. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. It is the day before the California primary, and we are honing in on the race for Sacramento mayor, which can be decided on March 5th, tomorrow, if a candidate gets more than 50% of the vote. Today, we're focusing on how the candidates would approach two of the city's most pressing issues, homelessness and affordable housing. CAP Radio reporter Chris Nichols profiled the leading four mayoral candidates, former city council member Steve Hansen, current state assembly member Kevin McCarty, former state senator Dr. Richard Pan, and epidemiologist Dr. Flojan Kofer. Chris joins us now with those conversations and analysis of the candidates. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Vicki. It's great to be here in studio.
Yes. Nice to see you, Chris. So there may be voters now with ballots not opened, and they have a big decision to make when it comes to mayor for the city of Sacramento. Before we dive into these profiles that you did, I mean, you've had some time now to reflect. What stood out to you about how each candidate views these pressing issues, homelessness and affordable housing?
Well, I think one thing that stood out is just how much in lockstep all four candidates are about Sacramento's homeless crisis being the biggest concern for the city. They really all agree on that. You know, overall, looking at these profiles, I think the most interesting part for me was learning about each candidate's backstory, learning how their life experience has shaped their approach to solving homelessness.
And we interviewed each candidate as more broad general profiles, but this is so important because you are our housing and affordability reporter, and that was your focus when interviewing them. We're going to go in the order that your reporting was published. So first up is former city council member Steve Hansen. What stood out to you about him?
I think Hansen probably has the most complicated backstory. He's the only major candidate who says they've experienced homelessness, but at the same time, he has arguably the most conservative plans for how to deal with the crisis. He says that as a child growing up in Minnesota, he was homeless off and on. He spent time living in a car with his mother, and at other times, he says they lived together at a domestic violence shelter.
Growing up, my parents divorced when I was young. I have a brother with autism who I haven't lived with since I was 7. He's now 49. He went to a group home. My mom and I moved around. She had abusive boyfriends. Police were over a lot to stop her from getting beat up or me from getting beat up. The windows would be smashed in. And I think between the time I was 3 and 10, I moved 9 times.
So with that background, I mean, one might think that Hansen's policy approach would be most compassionate, but you also say that he arguably has the most conservative plan for how he would deal with and address homelessness.
That's right. I mean, that was my assumption based on what we just heard and what I know about Hansen. But I think the experience that's really shaped Hansen's policy approach is his time living in Sacramento's Central City over the past 2 decades. For some reference, Hansen is now in his 40s. He runs a public affairs firm, and he and his partner are raising 2 young children. His family recently moved to Natomas. But let's listen to him back in early January describe his experience living near downtown, and then we'll talk about how he wants to confront Sacramento's homeless crisis.
The last neighborhood we lived in was Alkali Flat, and I was there for 16 years. We decided to move after homeless folks burned down a duplex and the fourplex across the street from us. Our daycare 2 or 3 blocks away, camps, needles around it, people lit on fire a vacant building right next to it, jumping the fences. As recently as 2 or 3 months ago, our littlest still goes to the daycare there. And the city has had, at best, an anemic response. And there is this palpable feeling that if they bury their head in the sand, it'll go away. But it's gotten so bad. Even this weekend on New Year's Eve, a huge homeless camp at 2nd and R, propane tanks blew up, caused a huge conflagration. And I understand it took a long time for the fire department to get there. But that camp had been an issue for 6 or 12 months. And the businesses, the employees, the people who live around there had complained. It's in the DA's lawsuit. And when you don't satisfy people's cries for help, the DA and others have stepped in to try to help them.
Okay, so there's a lot going on there. You have Hansen's lived experiences, him sharing that, you know, as a child, he had experienced homelessness with his mother. Also, him living in the city center in downtown, seeing a homelessness in his neighborhood, now moved
right
to
Natomas.
Right across the street from them. And then he also referenced the district attorney's lawsuit against the city. So remind us what that lawsuit is about.
Well, our audience might remember last year, Sacramento County District Attorney Tian Ho filed a lawsuit against Sacramento city leaders. And in that lawsuit, the DA alleges that the city has failed to enforce existing laws on homelessness. And this was, of course, a controversial move by the DA. Many city leaders have denounced it. They've said it's a political stunt and that it goes against recent efforts by the city and county to work together to address homelessness.
Does Hansen support the DA's move?
He does. He thinks it's been a wake-up call for the city and that it's caused Sacramento to be more responsive to concerns about the impacts of homeless camps.
Okay, so when it comes to his specific policy proposals on homelessness, what are they?
Well, his ideas, again, they're more focused on enforcement than just about any other candidate. For example, Hansen says he supports the concept of a citywide daytime homeless camping ban. And that idea was proposed late last year by 2 council members, but so far it hasn't gone anywhere. Hansen also says he wants to strengthen existing city ordinances, ones that ban camping near schools on private property, as well as the ordinance that prohibits camps from blocking sidewalks. In addition, Hansen wants Sacramento to aggressively go after funding for mental health treatment for unhoused residents. And Hansen also told me he wants to explore opening more of what he calls pallet shelters for unhoused residents. This would be communities with small cabin-sized shelters where residents can lock their own door. Those offer a little bit more privacy and security than the sanctioned campgrounds and safe parking places that the city has operated in the past.
Okay, so that is Steve Hansen, a former city council member with Sacramento. Now let's move on to the second candidate. This is current state assembly member Kevin McCarty, who also was a former Sacramento city council member. What kind of life experiences are shaping his views and his policy approach to these issues?
Right. And I just remember, we should probably say he was also a former CAP Radio board member, or I'm sorry, Steve Hansen was,
yes.
Just for full disclosure. McCarty is 52. He spoke with me also about his early family life. He moved to Sacramento when he was 2 years old. He considers himself the only lifelong Sacramento resident in the race for mayor. The other candidates moved to the city later in their lives. McCarty says his family moved around a lot when he was young, from South Sacramento to North Highlands, Arden Arcade, and other neighborhoods. McCarty was raised by a single mom who relied on after-school programs to keep McCarty and his brother safe while she was working. That experience, I think, had a really big impact on McCarty. He says it taught him the value of community programs and how they can be the difference between kids succeeding or not.
Sports kept me, you know, out of trouble as a kid. After school programs and sports programs kept my brother and I safe and out of trouble and kept us focused. And so, you know, I believe that activities for our youth are so critically important to help young people succeed.
Okay, so he is an advocate for community programs, especially when, you know, making sure kids get a good start in life. How does this relate to how he would confront the current crisis on the streets?
Well, like Hansen, McCarty says he does not believe people should be allowed to camp on public property. For some context here, Sacramento voters in 2022 passed Measure O, which bans encampments on city property. But that law can only be enforced if there's available shelter space, and that space is often not available. Here is more from McCarty.
Yeah, I don't support camping daytime nor nighttime on city land or public places or sidewalks. There shouldn't be any urban camping in Sacramento. Again, the flip side is we need to tell people where they can go. So the city has not done, I think, a good job of green lighting and opening up emergency sites today where people can go. It's one thing to say, hey, get these folks off of the field here at Georgetown Park. Get the people off of the middle of the park at McKinley Park. Get people off of the parkway behind Sutter's Landing. But the flip side, we need to show people where they can go.
Okay, but I also know over the last, you know, 8 years, you know, there have been these ambitious attempts to open up things that he just laid out. It can be really difficult to open up shelter sites. There's often pushback from the community, from neighborhoods. So what would McCarty do to speed things up, to expedite that?
Right. A lot of these ideas and plans, they kind of get shot down and they never turn into reality. McCarty says that Sacramento needs to get more creative and also more aggressive. He thinks that they should open emergency shelters at places like Cal Expo, on city property, and on vacant land under freeways.
Mm. You've also reported on really like the high costs that some of the city and county run shelters that they run up. I mean, what is his plan to pay for these?
Right. Well, McCarty and other local leaders, they're starting to talk about these costs. Some of the Safe Ground shelters can cost millions of dollars each year to operate. And McCarty says he wants to see if places like churches or nonprofits can run some of these sites for less money. Both he and epidemiologist Dr. Flojan Kofer, who we'll talk about later, suggested that Sacramento should also consider a self-governing model for some camps. That would mean designating a site, allowing residents to operate it, like at Camp Resolution, a large encampment in North Sacramento.
Well, and all of these mayoral candidates, if they become mayor, they're going to inherit the challenges between the county and the city. We talked about the DA's lawsuit against the city. What does McCarty think about it?
Well, he said he understands the frustration that's driving the DA's lawsuit, but he also says, and he's a big advocate for our local governments working together better. McCarty noted that he has worked with DA Ho in the past on public safety legislation and that he plans to work with him in the future.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio homelessness and housing affordability reporter Chris Nichols, who profiled the leading four candidates for Sacramento mayor, a race that can be determined in the primary tomorrow if a candidate gets more than 50% of the vote. So we heard from State Assembly member Kevin McCarty. First, we heard from former city council member Steve Hansen. Now let's move over to Dr. Richard Pan. He is a former state lawmaker as well in the state Senate formerly. What did you learn about his background that might shape his approach to homelessness?
Well, Pan says he's going to draw on that background as a state legislator. He's going to draw on his experience as a physician. He worked for 12 years as a pediatrician for UC Davis Health before being elected to the state Senate representing Sacramento. And Penn says he continues to volunteer at a county-run clinic where he serves patients who are uninsured or on Medi-Cal. So with that background, Pan told me he's learned how the different layers of government work, how they need to work together, and he says he's also learned how to make sure policy actually becomes practice.
Oftentimes, when you're elected office, you're in the legislature and city hall, right, some of these discussions can get, you know, policy discussions get a little bit theoretical, right? And sometimes people say, oh, look, I passed the bill, or I passed the ordinance, we've solved the problem. Well, that didn't solve the problem, right? It's implementation that's really important, right? It's the follow through. In fact, one of the things that's really important to me was, as I said, in the beginning of the week, I helped shape the rules. At the end of the week, because on Fridays I go to the clinic, I had to live by them, my patients had to live by them. I had to deal with the real world consequence of what actually happened as a result of the bills or laws that I passed.
Okay, so that's really telling of Dr. Pan's mindset, his philosophical approach that he would bring to the mayor's office if elected, but what specific initiatives would he push for?
Pan says he will push for ways to prevent more people from falling into homelessness. Unfortunately, we have more people ending up on the street than are coming out and into housing. He says he'll urge the city to use federal dollars to support people at risk of losing their home through a program called CalAIM. That program provides Medi-Cal enrollees with help finding a home and a subsidy to help them stay housed.
What is his view on the role that enforcement can play to address the city's homelessness crisis?
Well, he feels that there should be more enforcement, and that is reflected in my conversation with Pan about District Attorney Tian Ho and the DA's lawsuit against the city. Pan told me he agrees Sacramento is not being responsive enough.
First of all, I am endorsed by the DA because he knows I'm the partner that he's going to best be able to work with to address these problems. And I think his actions were reflective of the frustrations of people here in the city of Sacramento. I mean, he had 3,000 people come and file complaints as part of his lawsuit, right? I think that reflects the frustration people have about what's going on in their neighborhoods. And as elected officials, as leaders of the city, we need to respond to that, right? So we can, you know, look at it. It's not a DA issue alone, right? It's not that this is the DA and he doesn't have other people in Sacramento saying, yes, please do something, right? They're turning to the DA because they feel like the city is not being responsive enough. And I think that's the root of the problem that we need to get to, right?
So you are supportive of what he's done.
Yes, I am. Yes, okay. Yes, because I think that he's calling to attention. In fact, I think we do see some changes in how city leaders are, you know, addressing some issues because of that.
All right, that is former State Senator Dr. Richard Pan running for mayor. Now, rounding out the four conversations you had with the leading mayoral candidates is epidemiologist Dr. Flojan Kofer. What stands out about Dr. Kofer?
Well, Kofer is unique. She's the only candidate who is not a current or former elected official. She is no stranger to city government, having chaired Sacramento's Measure U Community Advisory Committee. She's also the youngest candidate, the only woman running. If she wins, she would be Sacramento's first Black female elected mayor, and she's definitely challenging the city's status quo.
What distinguishes me from my opponents is I'm not more of the same.
And if you do what you've always done, you'll get what you've always got. And Sacramento is at a place where people don't want what they've always gotten. They want new leadership, they want some new ideas, and they want some different outcomes. And that's what I think distinguishes me from the field.
Okay, so how is COFR proposing to achieve these different outcomes for Sacramento residents?
Well, like the other candidates, COFR says she wants to make sure Sacramento not only responds to today's crisis on the streets, but also takes steps to prevent things from getting worse. She was the only candidate who told me Sacramento should revisit rent control to slow down rent increases that in some cases can push people out of their homes.
But didn't the city council already pass a rent control ordinance like a few years ago?
Vicky, it did. Back in 2019, the council approved a law that says landlords can't raise rents more than 10% per year. And a year later, voters rejected a measure that would have strengthened rent protections. But COFR says since then, affordability has only gotten worse and the city should take another look at rent control.
Okay, so that is a strategy that is proactive, keeping people in stable housing. But what would she do about the people who are currently vulnerable on the streets and in encampments today?
COFR says Sacramento needs to establish more safe ground camping and parking sites. That's similar to what McCarty wants to do. But one of the major differences between COFR and the rest of the candidates is that she opposes any broad sweeping bans on encampments in the city. She also does not support the DA's lawsuit against the city. At a press conference last year, COFR said the DA's legal threats and enforcement first strategy are, quote, cultivating an environment of punishment and cruelty, end quote.
What did you learn about COFR's life experiences that shape how she views homelessness and the solutions to it?
Well, I think she has some of her own personal experiences. She talked about both friends and family experiencing homelessness. I think some of this explains why her policies would probably have the greatest focus on the welfare of unhoused individuals compared with the other candidates.
I also approach this from the lens of I have friends and I have an uncle who are sometimes are unhoused. My uncle has schizophrenia and at times he lives in Philadelphia. And at times we lose him and we can't find him. And he, you know, especially if we're not able to maintain his medication regimen and those kinds of things. And so when I think about our unhoused neighbors, I recognize that to somebody else, they may just be somebody on the street. But to me, they are, you know, stand-ins for my Uncle Bubby. And I want, you know, he is loved and he is cared for and he is respected and he is an important part of a family. And I just want us to remember that when we're having this conversation about, you know, our neighbors, that these folks went to school with someone. This was somebody's baby that they cradled in their arms and had hopes and dreams for. And these are, you know, in addition to being fellow human beings, I want dignity and respect and consideration and compassion for them in a way that works for our entire community.
So we heard from the four leading mayoral candidates. You profiled them and they really focused on how they would address homelessness in the city. There is an important piece to this as well, and that's affordable housing. I mean, what did you learn from each of these candidates about how they would encourage more affordable housing?
Well, I thought it was interesting because all four candidates, unprompted, brought up the need to make it easier to obtain a city building permit. So they all agree on that. COFR offered a specific idea for how to do that. She says Sacramento should come up with pre-approved housing blueprints, ones developers could choose from. By choosing one of those, COFR says the developer could then skip much of the approval process. I think also of note, Dr. Pan told me that Sacramento must find ways to reduce the cost of subsidized housing. He cited projects that today are costing upwards of $600,000 per unit. And he says that expense is simply not sustainable.
And tomorrow is the big day. It's the primary for those with ballots still unopened, still a lot of time. So people can still and should very much vote. But what do you want them to take away from this conversation?
Well, and there's not too much time left, only a day. But at this point, you know, I think the decision is really up to the voters. I mean, hopefully they've learned something about all the four major candidates. We do have all of the profiles published online at capradio.org. You can also check out our Cap Radio Voter Guide online. It gives you a really good breakdown of all the city, county, and school board races. So get out there, fill out your ballot, turn it in by tomorrow at the latest.
Chris, thank you.
Thank you, Vicky.
And that is CAP Radio's housing and affordability reporter, Chris Nichols, who profiled the leading four candidates for Sacramento Rayer, a race that can be determined in the primary tomorrow, March 5th, if a candidate gets more than 50% of the vote. Still ahead, there is a new singing and dance performance that is opening up at the Sophia this weekend. It is inspired by the world's most famous fictional spy, James Bond. We're going to get a preview of Shaken, Not Stirred. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A new performance is debuting at the Sophia in Sacramento this weekend. It is drawing its inspiration from one of the most famous spy franchises of all time, James Bond, Agent 007. The show is called Shaken, Not Stirred, just the way, obviously, James Bond prefers his martini. And it does open up at the Sophia Saturday evening, and then there are two additional shows on Sunday as well. Joining us now with a preview are Jacob Gutierrez Montoya and Kendra Barrera from the Sacramento Contemporary Dance Theater, which is producing Shaken, Not Stirred with the Semantics Crier. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for coming in. All right, Jacob, where did this idea come from, this blend of James Bond and dance and music?
Yeah, well, Sam Schieber, who is the artistic director of Semantics, we love to collaborate. And so this idea kind of just became, it just sparked. And he is actually Sam who came to me and said, hey, we should do some Bond music. And I said, absolutely we should. And so, gosh, that was almost, I think that was pre-pandemic, actually.
Wow.
And so it's been kind of sitting there for a few years. And then finally we had this moment of just an opening in the way we wanted to kind of work our season. And it just was a kismet moment.
Wonderful. So yeah. It's been marinating now for a few years. Finally going to be coming to life this weekend. Kendra, what stands out to you about Shaken, Not Stirred? What do you want people to know?
Well, I think there's something that everyone can relate to in the show, whether or not it's getting dressed up for a fancy night out or a flirtatious moment or seeing someone who catches your eye. For Bond fans or not, I think that there are key themes that the audience can understand and relate to and enjoy through seeing it portrayed on the stage.
What do you want us to know about the Semantics Choir? People are just learning about them for the first time.
Gosh, they've been around for many years, actually. I think what they have kind of created this wonderful following of people who love the classical music, the classical arts, and really I think that they are just a great collaborator in Sacramento, and they pull singers from all over. I think we have a singer flying in from New York City. We have some people coming from the Bay, and so of course, I'm actually going to be singing in the show myself.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, with my husband, too.
Oh, that is great. And I just think about, obviously, that's a great collaboration between the choir and the contemporary dance theater. I would also think it could be a lift to choreograph alongside a choir. How did you all go about doing that?
Yeah, so there's 22 songs.
That sounds like a lot.
Yeah, no, it definitely has been a haul. Yeah, and it's been really inspiring and I think also challenging at times to just know exactly how we want the flow of the show to go, just because there is so much beautiful music. And it's fun to have a narrative, but I actually feel like this is going to be very motif-based. So little moments in the casino, little moments that are kind of just these hidden away moments at the bar. It's been kind of, as a creative, it's taken me a little bit of time to just understand exactly the way I want the show to flow. And so,
yeah, I would think that's really fitting because, I mean, a James Bond film is action, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very lively. And although 22 songs is a lift, I would think it really keeps it moving and you keep the audience, you know, going along with it. Maybe some suspense as well.
Totally. Intrigue, suspense. I think it's just like this nostalgia, this cinematic, these moments, these memories that pop into your head after seeing, you know, a Bond, all the Bond movies, if you've seen all of them. And I've seen quite a few now because of just studying the
for
work.
Prep.
Absolutely. And so there are just key moments that I think people who love movies and James Bond will connect with.
Kendra, what was different for you about learning the dancing and the show compared to other performances that y'all have done?
Well, I think combining the live singing with the dancing, as dancers, we're used to learning to one specific track, really honing in on the timing, the elements. And with this, there's more fluidity to that. So we have to be more flexible. We receive different recordings, new recordings, updated tempos. So that's part of what this process will be, especially this week going into our tech rehearsals, is how can we adapt on the fly and mold to some of those changes that happen.
What is it about the music and the theme of James Bond that works so well with a collaboration like this?
Well, I think it's that, especially with the types of dancing that we do, there's like slower movements that kind of go with our more contemporary bass, and then there's some fun jazzy moments. And so I think the singers have brought those dynamics to the songs and the way that they're singing them. And then we've been able to then adapt as dancers and kind of match how we're moving as well.
You know, I know you're in the 11th hour, so you are so busy working. But I wonder if at this point, do you have a favorite part of the show? Any favorite songs so far?
Gosh, I've got several now. but I actually just, we started kind of working on the casino section a little while back and just kind of seeing the theatrical components come together and seeing kind of the dancers really tell the story, being in that space. And I just really love seeing a different side of them, one that's not only going to be dance movement based, but truly interactive and that personal approach to being in a space like that. So I love watching them do that.
What are some of the songs?
Oh, gosh. You've got For Your Eyes Only. Of course, you've got Skyfall. There's going to be an original, a new one that is going to be inspired, or is inspired by all of them together, called Shaken Not Stirred. And you've got, of course, the Bond theme will be coming out. You've got Goldfinger, which is amazing. It's just such an expressive piece. So, yeah, there's going to be some zingers.
I would imagine also, I mean, I don't think there's any shortage of James Bond fans, but you don't necessarily have to watch all of the movies to really enjoy what you're about to take in on Saturday and Sunday.
Absolutely not. No, you get to come and you get to experience, I think, just a treat of the senses. It's going to be something, I think, for everyone, like Kendra mentioned.
How do you want people to feel, you know, once they leave?
I think inspired by what two art forms collaborating can feel like. I think also, again, having something specific from the show that spoke to them or that they could relate to or maybe took them back, and having thoroughly felt entertained.
Mm. You know, when it comes to the dancers, I mean, how are they doing? These artists that are, you know, having to have in their minds, you know, 22 songs that they have choreography to.
Gosh, I'm just such a big fan of my dancers. I think that they are just so well equipped to take in information and knowledge and just be able to produce something that kind of has been simmering in my head and then create the landscape. And it's pretty immediate, actually. And we all have high expectations of each other. So I think it's really beautiful to watch everyone just kind of bring it to life.
How many people, artists, are part of the Contemporary Dance Theater in Sacramento?
We have 16 company members, and we have 4 apprentice company members.
Wow.
So we have 20, and then there's 9 singers for semantics.
I just think this also highlights just the value of collaborations between different local arts programs and venues. I mean, that's something that I think there could be a plethora of here in Sacramento.
Yeah, absolutely. We're such, I think, a fortunate organization to be able to also do it at the Sophia, who is a partner in our organization. They're always sponsoring us to be there.
And a beautiful venue as
well. Absolutely. We are so grateful for that partnership. And so I absolutely think there is this collaboration, not only between SCDT and Semantics, but also the Sophia, who houses numerous nonprofit organizations throughout the year. So huge shout out.
Yeah, I mean, Sacramento is a big city. There's, you know, 500,000 just in the city center alone. But, you know, the local arts, I think you all are a tight-knit group and you support each other.
100%. Yeah, I love going to see shows at Cap Stage and, of course, B Street and, of course, Broadway Sacramento. I think we all just, we get to really just support the mission and the vision that we all have for.
I just think about how 4 years ago this week, you know, the whole world changed and the stage shut down. And then now we're talking about another performance at the Sophia and being able to be in person. I mean, it must be just invaluable, that type of experience, to get back again as artists like yourselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're very, very, very happy. I remember that day very well.
Well, good thing it's in the rearview mirror.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, Jacob and Kendra, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Jacob Gutierrez Montoya is the artistic director and choreographer for the Sacramento Contemporary Dance Theater, and Kendra Barrera is the assistant artistic director, and they've been previewing a new James Bond-themed singing and dance production called Shaken, Not Stirred. It is opening up at the Sophia Saturday evening, and there are two additional shows on Sunday afternoon and early evening. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to reach out to us, you can send us an email, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Leshinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and audio engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. And our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.